Today's program is brought to you by Cloud Ride, the first vape juice with flavors created by a James Beard award-winning chef. For more information, visit cloudridevapor.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte.
My name is Souther Teague.
And we have
an esteemed guest today. Our third author this month.
Yeah. And actually, it's his third time on The Speakeasy. Welcome back to the show, Robert Simonson.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Yeah.
Good to have you back, man. First time you're on was with your first book, The Old Fashioned.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Great book. It's awesome to, like, travel around the United States and go to all these different bars and, like, see that book. And not just necessarily in cocktail bars, but in just every, like, almost every bar I feel like I go to that has books behind the bar, there's the old-fashioned book.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thankfully, it's not a trend that came and went. It seems like they're still making old-fashions. They're still drinking them.
I mean, it's one of the go-to drinks. It's like it was a really great idea. It's a great book, a lot of great content in there. One of my business partners, Daniel Krieger, shot it.
Yeah.
It's beautiful photography,
gorgeous book.
And then the last time you were here was with your app,
right,
which has been very helpful for me. The modern classics of the cocktail renaissance
came out in February in collaboration with Martin Dudaroff.
And so, okay, so now you've just put out this book, came out on the 20th of September, called A Proper Drink, The Untold Story of How a Band of Bartenders Saved the Civilized Drinking World. It's a story, like, it reminds me a lot of, kind of the inspiration of, like, putting the show together, you know, like in the archives of the show, we've talked a lot about the modern history of getting these drinks back together to where they're supposed to be. And you've put this into a book, and it's really amazing. It's really, first of all, it's a beautiful cover.
Yeah.
It's one of the coolest fonts I've ever seen. It's super classic, but apparently you were telling me before the show that, this font is only a year old, but it looks like it's like 160 years old.
Yeah, it's a beautiful font. Well, you can't all see it out there in Radio Land, but you have to trust it's a beautiful font.
You have to buy the book.
They've done a 10-speed press, published the book, and they did a great job with the cover. This book is kind of the polar opposite of the old fashioned. The old fashioned was super focused, kind of just a little micro book about one specific, very specific topic, one drink. And this book goes totally macro. It's just the broad focus of the entire cocktail revival of the past 25 or 30 years. Basically answering two questions. Why did it happen? And who was responsible?
Yeah, and you reel the clock all the way back to the book begins somewhere in the 70s, right?
Yeah, I start painting the picture of, like, what drinking life, what bar life, the bar world was like back then, what we now universally term as the Dark Ages, when people weren't drinking, I don't know, with an educated palate, I guess. And then how that came to be turned around slowly but surely. And then start talking about the early important figures in New York. You've got Dale DeGroff in London, Dick Bradsell. Mm. There are other peripheral figures that also, there are many people who played a role in this, but obviously those are two of the main ones.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of spreads very slowly throughout the 90s and then very quickly throughout the aughts.
Well, yeah, the internet.
The internet played a huge role. There's a chapter about the internet. It can be argued, and I think it's inarguable, without the internet, the cocktail revival would not have happened and certainly would not have happened as quickly.
Sure.
I mean, in the beginning, these bartenders who were interested in making old cocktails right had to go to eBay or old bookstores or flea markets to find the old cocktail books, because all of them were out of print. After Prohibition, there were no cocktail books that told you, like, okay, we know there's this drink called the Widow's Kiss, and we're trying to make it. It doesn't taste good. What's wrong? And so you'd have to find these old books. So that's how the early pioneers did it. But once the internet started coming into play, you could be in Seattle, you could be in Singapore, you could be in Paris, get on your computer and gather the knowledge and talk to someone halfway across the world, like, I'm trying to make a Rob Roy. It's like, how do you do it?
Yeah.
Yeah, shared information became much more commonplace. And
well, it created a bartending community. There was no bartending community. That's hard to believe today because you guys are so, you know, you're thick as thieves. Close, you all know each other.
Close-knit, yeah.
You're very close-knit. You travel to these cocktail conventions. You go to each other's bars. You talk on email and the internet and text. Back then, everyone
with boomerangs. I mean, yeah. most of my conversations happen with boomerangs.
Yeah, boomerangs is another way to communicate. But then everyone was like working in silos. You were all by yourself and trying to figure it out. And if you were lucky, Dale DeGroff would come and find you and visit your bar. But a lot of people weren't lucky. And so this changed everything.
I feel like a lot of it was due to... I feel like a lot of the like nerdy like circles of like bar enthusiasts were... I think a lot of it started with tiki stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And then you have a chapter devoted just to that as well, right?
Yes. It's toward the end of the book. One of the last categories of drinks, categories of American cocktail history to be reclaimed was tiki, because as people were starting to make pre-Prohibition classic cocktails again, I mean, it's hard to remember. It's part of the reason why I wrote this book is because people had started to forget this stuff. But 10, 15 years ago, a lot of mixologists looked down their nose at tiki. They thought, we're not going to make those slushy drinks. This is a classy bar. We're trying to impress people with our cocktails and with our profession. And it took people, basically one person, Jeff Barry, to tell them this, like, no, you don't understand tiki drinks. If they're made well, they're as good as any drink, and they deserve your respect. And so... You know, he did the shovel work. He dug up the old recipes. He published the books, and he brought back that chapter in cocktail history.
Well, we had to go through. Don't you feel like it was necessary that we had to go through a kind of a I feel like it was
the
kind
asshole
of a,
period.
An asshole.
The
period.
Asshole period.
Thank you. Thank
yeah,
you. We had to be assholes for a while.
We had to be assholes.
We had to be holier than thou, but that led us to a place where we could then be more relatable.
Yeah. Like you cracking a Budweiser right now.
Yes. Well.
No.
Good afternoon, America.
That chapter, which people like to bring up as being regrettable, I think was absolutely necessary. Yes, the bartenders had to be hard asses for a while because they had to retrain the drinking public. You know, it's like try this.
There was a lot of pushback from
a lot of pushback, and you guys had to be brave about it. And then eventually, once people started to know what you were doing and that you were actually not being jerks just to be jerks, but on principle. Then you could ratchet it back a bit and get back to the hospitality thing, which we've been reclaiming the past 5 years or so.
Taking your craft seriously, but not taking yourself too seriously.
Right, exactly. But yeah, it had to be done.
It was a necessary step in the evolution of the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Bronco had to be busted.
Right.
I mean, it's. I always liken it to the kitchen. Like, you can't just walk into most you can't walk into a fine restaurant and just order, like, whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Without looking at the menu.
Yeah. I see that you've prepared all this stuff, but I'd like something not prepared.
Yeah. No, there's a quote in there from Camper English, who's a cocktail writer in San Francisco. And he was talking about, everyone knows that you go into Chez Panisse and you can't order a cheeseburger.
Yeah.
But they get upset when you go to a cocktail bar and you order a Cosmopolitan and they won't give it to you. It's just like, and they're like, this is the worst bar ever, you know, and they
you
get
order
indignant.
A French martini. I don't have Chambord.
Yeah, I talk about it like in very similar terms. You know, I think we've finally gotten to a place in the last couple of years where our guests now make a consensus before they go to the bar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they're standing on a corner and they say, let's go to a movie, they don't just go to the nearest theater and the movie that's playing right now. They make a consensus. One of them wants to see an action film. One wants to see a foreign film. Yeah. By the time the consensus is made, you buy your ticket and you know what you've bought. And you're not complaining that there's no subtitles in this action film that you thought was going to be a foreign film.
Mm-hmm.
So now people say, I want to go have a drink. Less and less are we just walking to the nearest bar and going in. We're saying, I want to go to that bar that's all rum, or I want to go to that bar that's all bitters, or I want to go to that classic cocktail bar. And they make that choice, and then they bought their ticket before they get in the door. It's a much nicer experience for everybody.
Yes, yes. It's a much different world now.
Yeah.
And there's a chapter in the book called The Scolds, which actually talks about when bartenders were in that era where I talk about Bourbon and Branch, which was notorious for, you know, scolding its patrons in the early days. there were a couple guys there, like John Santer and Dominic Venegas. And, like, they didn't want it to get too loud in the bar. And whenever it got too loud in the bar, they would collectively shush the entire room. Just go, shh.
Oh, like over the Burp Castle still does that in these fields. Yeah. But that's a beer bar.
And it became such a joke that after a while, the patrons would shush them back and just go, shh. and they admit now, it says, yes, we were total assholes, but, you know, we had to do it. We had to do it back then.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's... I can't even imagine doing that these days. That's...
And there's another.
I don't think there's any equivalent. I was trying to think: is there an equivalent to what goes on today? Does anyone do that?
No, that you wouldn't get away with that today.
It took me 4 years to bring in vodka to Prime Meats, and having that conversation was not easy.
Yeah,
especially being like an old kind of like Italian neighborhood, and people go into you know the Red Rose and having their vodka martini and. You know, like an 8-ounce pour of vodka, just cold and dirty.
Yeah. Ugh, I say as I raise my...
Phil Ward, who's a bartender and worked at Pegu Club and the opening staff at Pegu Club, which opened in 2005, he told me a story of how they used to play a game there of, like, how many questions they had to answer from a customer before they got a drink order. Mm. So someone would come up and say, I'd like a vodka and tonic. We don't have vodka. Okay. I'll have Captain Morgan and Coke. We don't have Captain Morgan. I'll have a Cosmopolitan. We don't have cranberry juice. And they would count.
Or the aforementioned vodka.
And whichever bartender got the most questions won, for the evening, like 7 questions before you got a drink order.
Yeah. That sounds like Phil Ward just in general. Like, yeah. I think he still does that at Long Island Bar.
Yeah, he may. He may. He's mellowed a bit.
it's been remarkable, like, you know, after a while, like watching the way that not only the bars have and the bars and the bartenders have progressed, but like the clientele, the customers have progressed as well.
They're certainly more educated than they used to be.
Yeah,
and,
man.
And you know,
I would say though we do live in this bubble. In
New
York
we're
City.
1%, right? Yeah. I don't even think it's New York City. You say this all the time, but I've never backed up what you say. Like. The kind of bars that we work at and that we kind of deal with and that we talk about, they're less than 1% of the total amount of bars that are out there. We live in a bubble inside
a bubble.
It's true,
but you could find trickles of the influence even in everyday bars. You look at the menu and you'll see a drink on the menu and say, that wouldn't have been there 10 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. You know? Yeah. I guess it was Dale who said, the goal with this revolution ultimately is to be able to go to the Howard Johnson's in Des Moines, Iowa and get a decent Negroni.
Mm-hmm.
Decent, just decent.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the goal. If we can achieve that, we won.
Right. Yeah, that's an admirable goal.
Yeah, I think so as well. Because I don't think it all belongs everywhere. I don't think anything belongs everywhere.
No, nobody wants all the bars to be cocktail bars.
No.
I've always said that like the term cocktail bar is kind of redundant because like every bar should
have at least one cocktail.
Get a cocktail.
Yeah.
You know, a bar is a bar is a bar, but like it's not. Unfortunately, that's not true. And yeah, you're right. It doesn't have to be. I mean, when I go to the post office bar in Luckenbach, Texas, you know.
Oh my God, I've been there. Have we talked about this?
No,
I've been there.
You've been to
Luckenbach? Post office feed and seed bar. Yes, I've been there.
Gift shop
and gift shop, of course.
Yeah, all I really want is a bottle of Lone Star.
There was a sign.
I'm not going there for like a Vue Carré.
Luckenbach, right. Texas, huh?
There was a sign.
Back to the basics of love.
Population 3. Everybody's somebody there.
There was a sign on the door. I don't need to get off track too much. There was a sign on the door that was misspelled, handwritten sign, that said at the post office feed and seed bar that said closed on Tuesdays. That's probably misspelled today, and it was. So I was there on a Tuesday and it was closed, but we went back the next day. Because I couldn't not go in and see that place.
Yeah, man.
We went one town over to Jordan.
Oh, you went to Jordan. You should have gone to Fredericksburg.
But Jordan, turns out...
Had some kolaches and schnitzel.
We went I heard they serve kolaches down there. That's weird.
Oh, yeah. There's a place in Bushwick that has kolaches.
I've been there.
Yeah.
Really?
No cocktails there.
It's Bed-Stuy. No cocktails. All right, we're getting off topic.
This is like the Texas show here.
Okay. Well, you know what? On that note, let's take a break and regroup and come back and talk with Robert Simonson about his new book, A Proper Drink, back in just a few.
Music for this commercial break is brought to you by RecTech, and this track has a pretty long title. It's called Meeting at the Docks to Discuss a Heist in Paris, 1961.
This show is brought to you by our sponsors at CloudRide. CloudRide Vapor. They make
e-liquids.
E-liquids for e-cigs. And you know what? We were just talking a little bit before the show. It's the perfect thing to have in the studio to...
Because did you call it smoking? What do you? It's vaping.
It's vaping.
We can vape in the studio without messing anything up or getting in trouble.
Can't mess up the microphones. So it's great. It's another testament to... The e-cig vibes. So if you go to cloudridevapor.com, you can actually get a 20% off discount using the code word SPEAK, as in the
speakeasy.
And check it out. It's cool stuff. They've got all these different flavors.
Created by a James Beard award-winning chef.
And
tested by scientists.
You love that part.
White coat to white coat.
All right, check them out, cloudridevapor.com. And we are back. You're listening to The Speakeasy. In the studio today, we have our good old buddy Robert Simonson, author, app creator, and...
New York Times writer.
New York Times writer, of course. We've been talking about his new book, A Proper Drink, which is out on 10 Speed Press. What a great publishing company, by the way.
They put out great food and drink books.
They really do.
They're kind of like the network. All about food and drinks.
Yeah, exactly, man. Go. We're just real tight that way.
The Heritage Radio Network.
And, you know,
going.
All due credit to them for actually thinking this story was worth telling because, you know, not everyone was convinced it was. Everyone, the food revolution, the beer revolution, the wine revolution in America, those tales have all been told. And that's the reason why I wrote this book is because this had not been told and I didn't see anyone stepping up to tell it. And it was only a matter of time before everyone forgot it. I'm sure you guys have had experiences where you talk to young bartenders.
Yeah, they don't know.
And
they just sort of
think it's been like this. It's been like this.
Totally.
You know, it's this great cocktail bars, great equipment, all this excess, access to these great spirits and liqueurs. And it's like, no, we had to work. We had to build this house.
Yeah, man.
I mean, Greg Baum was on the show
several weeks ago
on our 200th episode. And, we talked a little bit about, you know, like the how he started collecting these. I mean, he comes from a publishing family.
Mm-hmm. And he played a big role in this, you know, publishing, republishing all those out-of-print cocktail books, making them accessible to bartenders.
Absolutely. But then not only that, you know, the tools. We were talking a lot about how we definitely talked on the show a little bit about how we would he and I and Dave Wondridge would, like, we got to this point where we had to start emailing each other. And we're like, all right. It's my turn on eBay. I know you're looking at... I could tell because it was back when you could see the bidder's name, their screen name on eBay. And be like, no, it's my turn. Like, you got the last one. I'm getting this tool, you know, or this bottle or this punch bowl or whatever. But it was...
Yeah, tools were a big thing. I mean, yeah. I talked to so many bartenders and they all told me these stories, which are hard to believe today. You know, back in the day, all cocktails were shaken. Nobody was stirring any cocktails. So,
like the beginning of this book.
Yeah, in the early.
Or even before that, you know, like, I remember my fascination with those 1930s shakers that I collect is because of Thin Man movies and the opening scene in the opening movie.
Right.
He grabs the shaker from the bartender and he goes through this little ditty about how you shake a Manhattan to the Foxtrot and you shake a martini to the, you know, he goes through all these, and I'm like, you don't shake those drinks at all. But then I talked to Wondridge and he's like, oh, yeah, they did.
They did. And they're like, they tell these stories of how one day they decided they were going to do it right, and they came into work with a bar spoon. And there was no bar spoon in the bar, and it would create issues with the manager. The managers would get upset. It's like, what are you bringing that shit in here for? You know, we don't need a bar spoon. He said, we don't need jiggers. You know, it's just you're causing trouble. You're a troublemaker. This happened again and again in the
Wait,
early days.
The bartender was a troublemaker?
No way.
An independent thinker? A rebel? What are you saying?
But simple things like that, simple things that we take for granted, these tools. Yeah. And now you go to the store, you go to, I don't know, Bed Bath & Beyond, and you can choose from 10 to 15 different jiggers. Oh, I like this one.
Yeah, that's...
That's insane. That's a revolution.
There's there was a
quiet, drunken revolution.
Not so quiet.
Not so quiet.
Shh. Except at Bourbon & Branch.
Yeah.
Quiet. Or you won't get your drink.
Pipe down, you rebel.
In the 45 minutes that we promised you would get it in.
Oh,
God, those days.
Oh, the early days. Well, they had that terrible reservation system, so that when Bourbon & Branch opened, suddenly there were like 75 people in the bar that all wanted cocktails. And someone's at the end of that list.
Yeah.
And it wasn't an exaggeration back then. People were waiting a half hour, 40 minutes to get a cocktail. They weren't happy, but they kept coming back.
Yeah, that's amazing. Dude,
you guys have really, you know...
Those are the sympathizers of the revolution. They sympathized with the revolution. They just had their part to play was to not have to do any work, but to wait extra time to get their drink. And then be able to brag about it. I was at the Little Branch.
That's actually a big part of it, for sure, man.
Oh, absolutely. I think, I don't know it's if like I touch on that in the book, but like the guest has to be a sympathizer to this revolution or it wouldn't have happened, right? Like,
I mean, there were sympathetic guests. There were cocktail enthusiasts.
Alcoholics.
In the early days when any bartender was doing anything of interest in New York, San Francisco, the customers who cared found them. They just found them. You know, it's like they heard on the wire. You know, it's like, oh, Audrey Saunders is at the Beacon now. Let's go to the Beacon. Let's see what she's serving.
Like Julie Reiner, you know, started being sought out.
She was in a bar in off Greenwich Village called C3 that had nothing. It was nothing to speak of. Nobody was writing about it, but she had a little bar in the back. This was before Flatiron Lounge, and people found out. The word got out, and so suddenly Ted Hayes showing up and Dale DeGroff is showing up, and they're seeing what she's up to.
It's amazing, man.
It is amazing. And what's all, I mean,
it was an underground railroad.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, totally.
And then they get some recognition too. You know, the recent Death & Co. book. It's got little profiles and pencil sketches of several of their regulars with some quotes from them and their favorite drinks or things like that. It's like, they get rewarded for being the hangers-on.
There were people out there that wanted a different kind of drinking experience. They didn't want to stare at a widescreen TV and a place that was deafeningly loud and that had, like, three mass-market pilsners on tap. You know, they wanted something a little different. I know I did.
He's
drinking that Budweiser over there.
Listen, I'm in the studio. This is not the place for a proper cocktail. We don't have any stuff in here. But you just said it too. They wanted a different drinking experience. I think that's a huge part of the revolution as well. We've gotten to a place where it's not just about the function of alcohol. You know, it's the fashion of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can sit at home with a bottle of Jim Beam and get my drunk on.
Yeah,
but I want to go to a nice cocktail place and have a cocktail, or I want to go to just a bar and have a beer. There's different levels of experience there.
Yeah, the people that went to Milk and Honey in the early days, they went away. I mean, they had a good cocktail, but they remembered a lot of other things about that place too that made them come back.
Of course,
the whole atmosphere, the candles, the way the bartenders dressed, the way they comported themselves, the way the other guests comported themselves.
Yeah,
and you know those were all attractions to bring them back.
Yeah.
So let's talk about. I mean, obviously, the process of writing this book was probably pretty easy for you. I would say.
Anybody can do it, Damon. Why don't you write one?
Oh, my God.
No, I'm just saying, like, because you've been writing.
I'm still tired.
No, I know. But I'm saying, like, you've been lucky enough to be a part of it.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't fortunate in that way, in that I knew all the people that I wanted to talk to.
Right.
So there were certain people that said, like, no, you should talk to this person. I've never heard of them. And so I did. And I found and I learned something. But, yes, I knew how to get a hold of everybody. And most of the people I knew. Very few people said, no, I won't talk to you. They all pretty much said, sure.
And you did all this by phone, or did you travel?
I traveled. A face-to-face interview is almost always so much better than a phone interview.
I know. I hate doing phone interviews on the radio.
You can't see the person's face. You can't interact. There can't be dead patches. You know. You
can't clink glasses.
No, you can't have a So I traveled. I went to San Francisco. I went to Chicago, New Orleans, Boston, D.C. I went to London twice. I went to Paris. I went to Melbourne. I went to Sydney. Every city that I felt was important to the movement. And other people, like, you know, they're isolated figures. Like, there's Georg Meyer in Hamburg. I'm not going to go to Hamburg just to interview him. But he comes through New York, and I catch him then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's lucky you live here in New York. So.
Yeah, no.
A couple people a year come through New York.
I would hear on the grapevine, you know, it's just like Charles Schumann is in town.
Oh, right.
He's in town. Oh, my God. And, you know, I find him, and I corner him, you know, at PDT, and I interview him. So.
It's great.
Yeah.
How's your, how is, like, on the flip side of that, like, that's all before the book, but how was the experience, like, now that... I mean, you had your experience with the book tour with Old Fashioned.
Which was pretty small, actually. Yeah, this is much bigger.
Although, Souther was telling me that the biggest book night at
Warrior
Margo was your book, the Old Fashioned book.
Yeah. 48 books we sold, you said?
Yeah. And we
that was
more.
A great event. That was a great
we
event.
We sold more. We sold out really early. I typically only buy... You know, what I think I'm going to sell, maybe plus a dozen, and then I get the authors to sign the remainders and have them laying around so I can sell signed copies.
We had a lot of nice people show up that night.
I had reserved one to the side for myself, and I was like, fuck it, sell it.
Yeah, Souther was also the only person foolish enough to let me behind the bar. Let me make drinks.
Which is
not true. Because I saw you at Long Island Bar.
That's true. Well, Toby Cicchini is also foolish. Those are the two.
Speaking of that, while you're touching on it, I was going to talk about it at the end of the show, but next weekend on October 2nd, Sunday, we're going to do a book signing of this book, A Proper Drink, with Robert Simonson at Amoria Margo. We're going to start it at 4 in the afternoon. We're going to revise Double Buzz for that weekend, which is our Coffee and Tomorrow program in the daytime. And we'll roll into the evening a little bit. And maybe
what time does that start?
4 o'clock. 4 o'clock, yeah. Sunday, October 2nd, Amoria Margo, East 6th and Avenue A.
And we'll be making a few drinks that appear in the book, Modern Classics.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And if you want, again, you can get behind the bar. You didn't do a terrible job. I was bar backing for you, as I recall.
I was only making one drink. How terrible job.
Bourbon or rye. Bourbon or rye. He just kept yelling at the door. Bourbon or rye. Old fashions.
Yeah, I'll choose one drink to make again.
So where are you planning on heading for this book tour?
I will go to San Francisco. We're going to do an event at Bar Agricole on the 27th of September. There'll be an event at the Columbia Room.
Yeah.
Yesterday, yes, yeah. Exactly.
Oh, man, you are tired from writing this book.
I am tired. I'm actually going to go all the way over to Berlin later this month. And go to Bar Convent and talk on a panel with Charles Schumann and some of the people that made the cocktail revolution happen in Germany.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. So that'll be fun.
Cool.
Well, you know what? Again, like it's great having you on the show again. I haven't gotten a chance to really crack into the book yet. I know it's brand new, but
so many books this month.
So many books, man. We had Martin Gate. With the Smuggler's Code book?
Yeah.
Brad Thomas Parsons with his Amaro book.
Gorgeous book. Like there's only one page in that book that's terrible, that's ugly. It's a full-page photo of me.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. Sasha Petrasky's book is being published posthumously in November, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Georgette, right?
Yeah. Amazing. His widow completed that. So, some good books coming out. The Canon book. Uh-huh. The bar in Seattle, Jamie Boudreau's bar. They're coming out with their own book.
Yep. Man. Got to get him on the show. Love that guy. He's crazy.
Yeah.
He is crazy.
We got a lot of...
You can say that about him. He won't remember.
A lot of reading material this fall.
I know. I can't keep up.
Well, it's...
It was supposed to be a slow summer, but I got piled up with extra business, and then now books, stacking up books.
Yeah, well, you worked 3 weeks straight at... The Le French Diner.
Le French Diner, which is French for
The French.
The French
Diner. French Diner. Right. Yeah, that's a hard one to figure out.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
I love that place. Go visit.
Yeah. So hopefully, you know, I mean, the book will remind people where this all came from. And also, I think there are a lot of people out there that enjoy cocktails and have no idea why this happened.
Yeah. And you know,
so it's like all of a sudden, why am I getting better Manhattans than I used to? You know, it's like, I don't understand and I don't care. They taste good, but might be fun to find out.
Yeah. And, you know, like we said before, earlier in the show, I think it's a really great opportunity for a lot of like new bartenders come into it, and new bartenders who've started in the last, you know, few years to, you know, 10 years mm-hmm. to find out. And so I think you did a really great service of writing this book. And so thank you for doing that.
Yeah, it's also beautiful, very tactile. Can't wait to dive into it. And yes. Definitely can't wait for you to come sign the book at tomorrow. We'll see if we can break the record.
Yes, we got it.
Absolutely, man.
Everybody out there, you're responsible. You have to come in and help us break this record.
That's right.
You got to sell 50 books.
And then in addition to the book, you're updating your app, right?
The Modern Classics of the Cocktail Renaissance, which came out in February. We always intended to update it as it seemed like it was warranted, and we're adding 3 drinks, and that will drop sometime this fall.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
That's awesome.
Well, you're a very busy man, and I'm glad that you took the time to come to the studio today and sit with us and goof around and talk about your book, man.
Oh, so always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, man. Thanks again, Robert Simonson. Check out the book, A Proper Drink. It's on 10 Speed Press.
Available at your finer bookstores.
Yes.
Nice. Well, that's it for the Speakeasy this week. Until next week, I'm Damon Bolte.
My name is Souther Teague.
And cheers,
cheers,
guys.
Everybody. Thank you so much.
Cheers.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The groove's grooving, the rhythm and blues that's him. It's gonna get you some.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.